studios of KPCW in Park City. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz, and this morning we bring you two of our recent favorite interviews as a rebroadcast episode. First, Lynn Ware-Peek and I speak with journalist and author Christy Eschwanden about metabolically healthy obesity. Then, Lynn Ware-Peek speaks with ultra-runner Charlie McKee, who in 9 months and 21 days summited all the 162 named peaks with public access in Salt Lake County. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
So there's this acronym, MHO, which means metabolically healthy obesity. So someone who might qualify as obese when their BMI, or body mass index, is measured. But healthy in this case means someone who is considered obese but doesn't have any of those regular markers. They don't have high blood pressure or high cholesterol levels. They don't have insulin sensitivity, triglyceride counts, or high liver fat levels. So what's behind this discussion? We've long been taught that obesity leads to heightened health risks. Well, joining us now to explain it all is science journalist and author Christy Eschwanden. She's written an article in the recent issue of Scientific American titled, "People Who Are Fat and Healthy May Hold Keys to Understanding Obesity." Christy Eschwanden, welcome back to The Mountain Life. Great to have you.
Oh, it's great to be back. Thank you so much for having me.
I bet you found this really interesting. I know you, as a person who's been a longtime endurance athlete, to uncover this whole thing about these discrepancies with body mass index and being healthy. How did you first come across it?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Actually, my editor at Scientific American said, I wrote a big feature for Scientific American about, the title was The Rise and Fall of Vitamin D, about how vitamin D, you used to think it's, cured everything, and now we're realizing that actually most people don't need supplements, and people that are told they're deficient probably aren't. Anyway, that's a whole other story, but that was a pretty research intensive story. And he said, I have something else I'd like you to look into. So I didn't know that much about this topic when I started reporting, and then I got into it, and it was just fascinating. And, I think it's really something that hits on so many things that our culture whether you are thin or fat, weight is something that we're all aware of. There's so much stigma around it. It's really, and we're at this cultural moment now with these new obesity drugs where things are really changing. And I think it really brings a lot of these issues to the forefront.
Yes. And in this recent issue of Scientific American, there are several articles kind of around this topic.
Right.
We're talking about Ozempic. We're talking about how these weight loss drugs are really revolutionizing how we look at weight, how we look at health. There's something about body mass index, though, and I've heard other people talk about the BMI being kind of faulty somehow. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. In fact, it is so problematic that the American Medical Association pretty recently actually put out sort of a statement saying that, we need to be careful, that BMI is not a good marker of health, and that, basically trying to push back against the misuse. Because as you said, BMI is a very imperfect measure of obesity. And I think here we need to take a step back. And part of the issue here is that, we're looking at what is it that's actually harmful to health here. It's not your absolute weight. It's really about excess fat, and not just excess fat. It's really a lot about where that excess fat is stored, what sort of metabolic problems it may be causing. And that's not universal at a certain, you can weigh the actual fat, right? And it could vary from person to person. And so there's an individual aspect to this, but BMI is really just a measure of height versus weight. And so it's a very, very crude measure of obesity. And there's pretty widespread agreement in the medical community even that this is not an ideal way to diagnose obesity. The problem is that we don't really have anything better. There have been some other things proposed. So hip to waist ratio seems to be superior to BMI in most cases, in terms of looking for excess fat that might have these metabolic issues or metabolic problems. But that's a tricky one, and it's still not perfect. Actually, looking at body composition, which is more what we're interested in, right? Like how much fat someone has versus lean body weight. That may be better, but again, that doesn't capture where it's stored, which seems to be important. So it's interesting because the kind of fat storage that people really try to avoid, you know, you don't want to have fat on your hips and your butt and all these other places. That's actually sort of the healthiest place to store it. So subcutaneous fat seems to be less harmful to your health than fat that's stored internally around the organs. And that is why, you know, having a larger waist seems to be a greater risk than, say, carrying excess fat on the hips or buttocks or legs and things like that. So that's kind of interesting. And we're still really in early days in terms of understanding the metabolic stuff that's going on here and understanding how that impacts health and impacts metabolic health.
What would you say are some of the biggest myths that you discovered when you were working on this of people's associations with obesity and poor health?
I think one myth is just, you know, we really have a terrible problem in this country, and probably not just this country. It's the stigmatization of larger bodied people. And I think we have to be really careful here. And again, you know, people, there are a lot of different body types that people have. And just because someone's larger doesn't mean that they're having health problems associated with that greater size. And so I think it's really important to, and this also very much goes to healthcare providers, to not be stigmatizing and not making assumptions. I mean, this condition that I wrote about, metabolically healthy obesity or MHO, they're finding that there are people that are extremely fat, you know, have very high BMIs, they're carrying a lot of excess body fat, and yet they don't have these metabolic problems. And so it's really, you know, not correct to call them unhealthy. You know, and there's this controversy of, well, you know, they're going to eventually develop these problems and diabetes and things. But, you know, as long as they don't have it, you can't say that they're not healthy. And so I think it's really forcing researchers and doctors to rethink how they consider this. And I think what it's really showing is that the relationship between body weight and body fat and health is far more complex and nuanced than we'd like to think or that we've been told. And so I think we really need to pull away from this assumption that because someone is larger bodied or even has higher body fat, that they're necessarily unhealthy. Now, that said, there is a very large and robust body of evidence showing that these health problems, and we're talking here about things like diabetes, heart disease, cardiovascular disease. There's also some things that are not metabolic problems. So, for instance, arthritis can be much more problematic. You know, losing weight is a really good way for many people to improve some of their arthritic symptoms. Sleep apnea, there are some other things that are caused are linked to higher body weight. But I think we need to be really careful about the stigmatization and this idea that just because someone's larger, that they're inherently unhealthy. And, you know, for the story, I talked to some people, a physician who really specializes in treating larger bodied people, who really said, you know, we don't need to talk about weight. Let's talk about the issues that are really happening. Let's talk about someone's blood pressure. What can we do to decrease it if necessary? Let's talk about, are they exercising? Let's talk about diet. Let's talk about these things. But I think, you know, there's a pretty good body of evidence showing that stigmatization of larger body people is just as harmful. So it's a little bit of a balance here too. We also have decades and decades of research showing that it's very, very hard for people to lose weight. It's even harder for them to keep it off. You know, these new obesity drugs may change that, but that the problem remains. You know, they're not available to everyone. They're very expensive. I think it can really increase problems of equity. So I think, you know, there's going to be people who are going to be living in larger bodies, and we need to, you know, help them feel healthy and safe and comfortable in those bodies. And healthcare providers need to treat them, you know, with kindness and to acknowledge that, and not to stigmatize and, you know, sort of treat the larger body as if it's inherently unhealthy. And I think that, you know, we're really seeing that can be just as harmful, because you have people who are avoiding healthcare because they don't want to be stigmatized by their doctors. And this is a very well-documented problem that's out there.
Yeah. And I think it's been proves psychologically too that shame is not the best motivator.
Right. You
know, we could really do better with different formats. So mm-hmm. is there kind of a sweet spot or a safe zone that even people who would show up as obese on the charts that you find this is an area where typically you're going to find the metabolically healthy people, and then past this point you might find more issues, or is it just across the whole board?
Well, definitely, you know, people who have extremely high BMIs or very high body fat, body weight, you know, they're going to be at more risk. So if you're just a little, you know, just barely in the obese category, your chances of having issues are going to be less. It's interesting. There's actually, and this is data that's been replicated again and again, being overweight. So in the overweight, which is not obese, but it's about BMI of 25 to just under 30. Actually, people in this category have lower mortality rates than people in the quote unquote normal. And I don't like using the word normal because, you know, obviously we all exist on this continuum, but you know, people who would qualify as non-obese or non-overweight. And so, you know, I think one of the messages here is that being a little bit overweight is not so bad for you necessarily, and particularly as you age. And this is something that I found really interesting. And that is, as you get older, your body composition tends to change. This is just natural stuff. Yeah, this is the reason that you're really told as you get older, it's so important to do weight-bearing exercise and strength training, because you know, you're naturally going to be losing lean muscle mass. And so, you know, you can counteract that with exercise and with strength training. But this is kind of a natural process that happens. And particularly if you're not doing those things, your body composition changes. And so you tend to have more fat. But what can happen then, because muscle is weighing more, you may end up, you know, if you're retaining some of that, your BMI may actually go up a little bit. And yet that's protective. And so as you know, if you are over 60, 65, and this is really the key, if you're 18, you probably, you know, being overweight that age is probably not so good. But as you get older in these older age categories, it seems to be a little bit protective perhaps, or at least not as bad, you know, not something to worry about in that sense. Now, again, you don't want to be getting into the morbid obesity categories where it's a lot. But I think one of the messages here is that, you know, there's a lot of different things that we need to balance to be healthy. And as you get older in particular, a lot of the doctors that I spoke to said, you know, what we really need to focus on is making sure that people are having those healthy habits. They're eating well, they're exercising, they're doing other good things for their health, you know, social interactions, things like this. And that, you know, being slightly overweight is not a list of priorities compared to those other things. And especially given how hard it is for people to lose weight. And, you know, what could be more harmful to someone's health than saying, you know, your body weight is bad, we need you to get down, and there's no way to really do that, and so we're just sort of setting you up for failure. I think that's not helpful. And so, you know, this physician, Mara Gordon, she's at the Cooper Medical Center in New Jersey. She really specializes in working with larger body people. And she said, you know, we really focus on the health stuff. We don't need to talk about weight. We don't focus on it. We focus on what's your cholesterol, what's your blood pressure, you know, do you have good insulin sensitivity? Are you exercising? You know, what are you doing with your diet? And those are things that are actually actionable too. You know, people can try and lose weight and do things, but if they're doing these healthy habits, this should happen on its own. And so, you know, again, it's about getting away from that stigmatization of larger bodies.
Yeah. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with journalist and Scientific American contributor, Christy Ashwandan. She's also the host of a Scientific American podcast called Uncertain, really interesting, and a co-host on a podcast, another podcast. Oh, shoot. What's it called, Christy?
Emerging Form.
Emerging Form. And that's about the creativity process. And she's the author of a book that we interviewed her about when it came out in 2019 called Good to Go, What the Athlete and All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. That was such a great book.
Oh,
and I've gotten a lot more massages since. I wanted to ask you, you know, we also know that there are fat, skinny people. In other words, and that's probably not the term that is used, but there are very thin people who have fatty organs who are, you know, who have high cholesterol, who have all of these criteria that typically would be associated with someone who's obese, but they're not healthy, even though they're thin. So that seems like a contradiction that also sort of supports what you have written about this month in Scientific American.
Absolutely. There are people who are, you know, their BMIs are low. They are not heavy. They may be skinny, but they have, you know, high proportion of body fat. They have a lot of fat around their organs. They are metabolically unhealthy. And I think, you know, this goes back to these other issues that really matter a lot more than weight. And that is, you know, what is going on with you metabolically? You know, are you exercising, being physically active, and all of this, you know, I think it really goes to this idea that there's not a one ideal. There's kind of a continuum, and there are different ways to get there. So you can be unhealthy and thin, and you can be, you know, larger or fatter and healthy. So it really depends on what's going on with your metabolic health, what's going on, you know, physically and mentally too.
Yeah. I have this burning question, and I'm wondering, as sort of an endurance athlete yourself, if you know about Myrna Valerio.
I don't.
Okay. She's someone we interviewed on this show. Her name is Myrna. They call her the Myrnavator. You should look her up on Instagram.
Oh, okay.
She's obese, and yet she is a sponsored endurance athlete. Lululemon, LL Bean, Hydro Flask, Salsa Cycle. She's kind of the, it's like she represents the world of overweight people saying, we can still do this stuff. And I was just wondering, I'll edit this out, but I was just wondering, like, if her metabolic function has, you know, to what degree it's been tested. It would be really interesting.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. But yeah, it would be
okay. Well, let me go back then. I'll kind of rephrase a whole question here. A while ago, a moment ago, you talked about the hip to weight waist ratio, hip to waist ratio. Can you explain that a little bit more? Would this be the case where your waist is actually larger than your hips?
And that's... Yeah, or not necessarily, but it's a way of sort of measuring, you know, fat stored in the midsection seems to be metabolically less healthy than fat stored elsewhere. And
so apple-shaped folks.
Yeah, right, exactly. And so, you know, having, you know, fat in the belly is, you know, tends to be more harmful to your health than fat in the hips or fat in the butt or in the legs, lower body, or even upper body, you know, arms or whatever. And this hip to weight, so this hip to waist ratio seems to be one way of getting at that. Again, it's a crude measure, but it's a way to sort of measure that. So if someone is having a larger belly area, that seems to be, you know, more harmful to health in many cases than storing the fat elsewhere.
And then I read in the article that there may be as little as 6% of people considered obese that are this metabolically healthy obese, on up to 60%. And the criteria are kind of maybe a little vague. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's kind of ridiculous, right? It could be as few as 6% or upwards of 60%, depending on how it's measured. And in the story, I talk about a few studies that have looked at this. And what it really comes down to is how you define it. And so how stringently it is defined decides whether it's 6% or 60%. So on that higher scale of 60%, that's usually definitions that are saying, well, there maybe are five or six markers of metabolic health, and as long as half of them are okay, then we will call you healthy and all that. Whereas the very stringent ones are saying, if you have any of these things at all, then we're calling you unhealthy. So it really comes down to how it's defined. But the other thing I should just mention here is that there has been a push now. The American Medical Association actually put out a declaration some years ago stating that obesity is a disease. The WHO, World Health Organization, has similarly also defined obesity as a disease. And this has been kind of controversial. And I think some of this really comes down to, we don't have really good definitions of what a disease is. You know, it's really kind of a value judgment. And in fact, I spoke with very well-known researcher David Allison at Indiana University, who said, you know, obesity is a disease because we declared it one. You know, we just decided. And it really came down to, the reason that this was done was to help with reimbursement and to make it easier for doctors to be able to treat obesity rather than the health problems that might be associated with it. So, without obesity being declared a disease, you know, you might not be able to get some of these obesity drugs unless you were using it to treat diabetes, for instance, or, you know, other treatments and whatnot. And so it was really a move to try and open up access to treatments to obesity. And also, I think there was an idea that it might destigmatize it. We still have this cultural idea that people who are larger or who are fat, you know, they're lazy. It's something, you know, it's a personal failing. The science shows that that's usually not the case. It's really, you know, this is not something that is on someone's, you know, they've chosen to be this way. And we know that there's a continuum of body types that people are born with, and it's not easy for everyone to be thin. And so, you know, labeling this as a disease, it's just like no one says when you get cancer, oh, it's your fault and you're terrible, right? And so there is the need to do that. Now, I spoke with some people on the fat acceptance movement, and they said, well, this hasn't really worked that way. And so now it's basically you're just being told that your body is a disease that's inherently diseased. And so we can debate whether that has had that intended effect. It has, you know, it has helped the industries that treat diabetes, or I'm sorry, it has helped companies and industries and you know, there's all sorts of money making things around treating obesity and trying to help people lose weight, some of which can be helpful, some of which, you know, probably aren't helpful. But it's interesting, and so I think it's really up for the debate whether we really should be calling it a disease and whether that's been helpful or not. The messages are mixed here.
Yeah, I bet the fat industrial complex gets very twitchy when people don't want to solve themselves anymore.
That's right.
At least there's been a really great wave of the body positivity movement of accepting at all sizes. I personally notice it a lot if I'm shopping for something online. 10 years ago, you saw one type of body and it was straight up and down, skinny white model. And now you see a lot of different shapes. And actually, I love how they're even showing things like stretch marks or, you know, things that aren't making us try to live up to this ridiculous ideal. And it just looks more like the traditional men and women. I would think that a study like this might really help support the body positivity movement. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's really just showing that, hey, you can't assume that someone who's larger is unhealthy and that they have all these health problems, and we can't. But at the same time, I think it's also about helping people who, you know, it goes back to this idea that people that are larger, it's all their, you know, they've done something terrible and they're bad people. We need to get rid of that idea. And so even if someone, you know, is obese and has some of these problems, I think we really need to get away from this idea that, oh, it's all their own fault. They're not taking care of themselves. They're a bad person. And, you know, really developing some humanity towards them and not stigmatizing those bodies, which I think just has a sort of spiraling effect for people too. There's some pretty good data showing that shaming people really just does not help. And in fact, can lead to eating disorders and whatnot.
I just finished Johan Hari's book, The Magic Pill, about the GLP drugs, which was fantastic. And he brings up a lot of things about what got us to this point where such a high percentage of people are obese. And I just wondered how do you find that line between being happy with yourself and whatever size you are, and also being motivated to be the best version of yourself that you can be?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I'm not sure I have an answer. I mean, talking to doctors who work with patients, the ones that I talked to really came down on, you know, we need to help people do the things that they can do, the things that are within their control. And in some cases that may be, you know, you need to take some blood pressure medications and that's fine, but you also need to, you know, don't just take the drugs, you need to exercise. You need to, you know, take these steps that are helpful for you. And some of these are just things like spending time outside, you know, having a good social network. I mean, this is not all just about drugs and food, right? It goes beyond that. And so helping people to do that. And oftentimes these things have sort of a pile-on effect. You know, someone starts exercising regularly, they start feeling better about themselves, they start feeling better in their bodies, and that can really motivate them and help them take other healthy steps as well. Yeah, but I think it's really about supporting people and looking at them as three-dimensional beings and not just a disease and not just, you know, the particular characteristic of their bodies.
It seems to me that we all ought to know about our metabolic health, and because that's the true determiner of health, yeah. Right? But really, that's, you know, that requires a trip to the doctor. Have you found in your research any other ways that people, you know, who may not be able to afford that, or their insurance doesn't cover it, or whatever it is, they don't have insurance, to find out about your metabolic health?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I talked to some of the experts that I talked to for the story said that this is one of the problems, is that we don't have an easy test, I mean, there are all kinds of tests that you can do. They cost money. They're usually not necessarily things that are going to be helpful. So you're basically just kind of going in and doing a bunch of tests that may or may not be called for. You know, if someone has an indication that something's going on, you may do some of these more specialized tests. Regular sort of blood panel will pick up on some of this stuff. But I think a lot of it are things that will show up at the doctor's office, right? Blood pressure. Yes, standard blood tests will often pick up insulin sensitivity. That's something that can be measured, but again, it's a little bit more that's a little bit more sophisticated test, and so you may need some sort of occasion to think that you need to look at that. So the answer is kind of like, no, there's not a good way to know about your metabolic health just with one easy test. Or, you know, it's not, this is one of the reasons I think that BMI is still so widely used, is because it is so simple. You know, it's height and weight that can be done, you know, in a couple of minutes in the doctor's office. You can do it at home. And so it makes it easy, whereas these other things are much more sophisticated. And again, you know, there are many different definitions of metabolic health. And so which factors are you looking at? And, you know, some of the more complex ones you may only measure if you have other issues showing up that suggest, hey, you should look at those other ones as well. But we don't have a sort of one and done test for that.
Well, just in closing, it's worth noting in the article somewhere, and you mentioned that Dwayne The Rock Johnson, who we all know, and he's so muscular, but his BMI is like 34, which would by the standard say that he is what, obese?
Yeah. He would fall apparently into the obese category. And I think no one who looks at him would say that he is obese. So it really just speaks to the fact that BMI is a terrible marker.
Well, Christy Ashwanden is our guest, and she has written a really interesting article in Scientific American that was released June 25th. It's called "People Who Are Fat and Healthy May Hold Keys to Understanding Obesity." So, Christy, thank you so much for coming back on The Mountain Life.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks so much.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Now, there are people who participate in the well-known races or events, you know, the Wasatch 100, the Park City Point to Point. And then there are other people who set other types of goals for themselves, perhaps less famous or sexy. Our next guest just wanted to explore her backyard on foot. Charlie McKee became the first person to tag the summit of every peak in her hometown of Salt Lake City. There are 178 total. The feat took her 9 months and 21 days, and she joins now to tell us all about how she did it and why it became a goal for her. Charlie McKee, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We very often, if we're competitive or we like to participate in races or events, a lot of times we make them and turn them into a vacation and go a couple states away or, you know, across the country or maybe even internationally. But you really had this idea of every peak in your hometown. Why was that?
I think you just hit on it. It's very much, I wanted to explore what is very available to me without having to exhaust resources. And I wanted to kind of force myself to pay attention to everything that maybe I wasn't already paying attention to when I go out for my regular trail run or for a ski tour or go rock climbing. There's just this entire playground, many world-renowned things about it. And I wanted to just make sure that I was doing myself a favor and seeing it all up close and personal and kind of sticking close to home and really appreciating the value of the place that I do call home.
Yeah, well, I like that idea. So often we don't know what's right behind us, or maybe we've never even met our neighbor. I'm wondering what constituted a peak? Because you say there were just under 180 of them. What was the qualifier?
Yeah, that was a great question, because a lot of this I had to kind of piecemeal together to create the ultimate map, but I wanted to do everything that was known. So most peaks have a name, there's the trail, there's some sort of demarcation that makes them a high point near something else. And so I took a combination of ski maps, trail running maps, just boundary maps, hiking maps. And if it happened to appear on one of those maps, that was it. And I kind of meshed them all together to create one that I thought would be pretty much everything included. And so that ended up being 178. And then the adventure really started. It was figuring out if these were possible. So anything that has a name, I was willing to at least explore it.
And, you know, from on a north to south, east to west trajectory, what was included there? Was it Salt Lake Valley? Was it only Wasatch? Was it the Ochre Mountains?
Yeah, so the entire boundary of Salt Lake City County was kind of what I was able to narrow it down to. And that actually includes the Ochre Mountains. It includes the southern end near Draper. It includes pretty much everything in Wasatch around Salt Lake City up to the Crest Trail. That is the marker on the east side, and it goes up to City Creek. So I thought that was a pretty big range. I had to make sure that it would be possible because I truly wanted to do all of the Wasatch. And I think that might have to be a few year goal because it's quite large. So I kind of wanted to keep it into my true backyard of Salt Lake. So everything that I can see from my house, from the grocery store, and really make sure that it was every inch of that playground.
Out of curiosity, how many peaks were there in the Ochre Mountains?
So actually, there's quite a few, and that was the majority of the private property because Kennecott Mine owns a lot. And so I was thwarted on many attempts to try to go to some of the smaller ones. But that one itself, if you included the private property, I think it boasts about 25, give or take a few, in the northern section. And so there's actually a southern section, and that is Kelsey Mountain, White Mountain area. Those are some of the pretty big ones. I got to get right up next to them with the Buttermilk Peaks, but those are also part of the Ochres. It's divided into two, which I didn't know until I started this project.
Well, nothing like creating a list, and many of us do this. You have a goal, something in mind that you want to do, but until you sort of quantify it or make a list or make a goal or, you know, say I'm going to do this much vertical or this many peaks, we're going to leave a lot out, this, especially for a project like the Ochre Mountains. I love it. Well, I guess, what were the peaks that were the most challenging for you? And had you climbed those already?
So there's a handful. And so I would say difficulty in this project kind of became two categories. Difficult as in it was seldomly done. There's not really a trail. It was kind of a quest difficult. And then difficult by technicality. So something about it made it just a little bit more strenuous. And so some of those peaks are very well known in the Wasatch for technicality. The ridgelines between Big Cottonwood and Little Cottonwood. There's a famous route called the Whirl, which is kind of a horseshoe loop through Little Cottonwood Canyon, and it goes across this very technical terrain, about fifth class scrambling, and the vast majority of it's very slow moving, incredibly dangerous. I had not done a large portion of that prior to this project. It had been something I'd always wanted to do, but once you kind of get up onto the ridgeline, you really are only able to move in one direction. Time-wise, fuel-wise, water-wise, nothing is working in your favor. It's very exposed. So you kind of get up there and you got to keep going. So you have to invest a lot of time and planning into that particular ridge, those ridges and those routes. So things like Dromedary Peak, Jepson's Folly, O'Sullivan, Sunrise, the American Fork Twins, those are really the big ones. And so that was really interesting. I had to work my way up kind of in my training to just make sure that I could actually get to a point where my body was able to handle like 10-hour days with very little water. And I felt comfortable being in that technical terrain. I wasn't going to shut down because I was scared or kind of slow down too much because I was afraid of moving across certain sections. And then the other difficulty of the project was the very questing centered summits. And so these are ones like Black Mountain in the northern section. That one I don't think has been visited by very many people at all. It's the actual summit of what is known more popularly as Little Black Mountain, which has a trail, but then it fades out and you are on a ridgeline bushwhacking. It's, I think, more visited by archers in the fall. There's a big hunting area over there. So there's very faint deer trails. There are occasionally some little clearings for footpaths, but for the most part, it is incredibly technical, very thick brush. I think those might have been truly some of the slowest miles of the entire project, walking through very, very thick oak brush, getting holes ripped into my shorts, and not having any water. And those are just, you're committed to going to a very particular spot on your map. And it's a different kind of fun, different kind of hard, but all the same, it's mostly a mental game when you get to those kinds of terrains. But I was very surprised to find a lot of enjoyment in both of them. And so I think for the most part, this project, if anyone were to ever kind of duplicate something of that matter, they would find the same set of difficulties, technicality, time, and then just absurdity.
If you're just joining me on the Mountain Lab, I'm having a conversation with Charlie McKee. She took 9 months and 21 days to climb, hike, run, ski. We'll ask that next. All of the peaks in her backyard being Salt Lake County. Well, and I want to clarify this. So the peaks are, there were about 178 peaks, but you weren't able to access all of them.
Yeah. So most of the private property is not in the scope of being able to request access. There are a few in the southern section. I'll use this as an example. They're actually on a military outpost.
You're not going there.
No, I grew up military too, so I'm very familiar the absurdity for them to be like, you want to just wander around our mountains above our military installation? Please don't do that. So I was thinking, okay, where are we going to make this something that is accessible in terms of a project for everybody? And so if it's private property, it required any kind of special access, I wasn't going to pursue that route. Although it'd be really lovely to have seen them all the different points of view in this project, I want it to be truly public. Quite a few were, I guess, on the initial list, but just not really conducive to being an accessible summit. So
you are an accomplished runner and sounds like you're a climber, a rock climber as well. And I'm assuming that you are an active backcountry ski tour. You had to start this because you finished in October. So you started in the middle of a winter, and it wasn't just any winter. It was the biggest winter that we've had in many decades.
Yeah. So I actually had to start the project in January, and I was very excited for this. Most of these summits that don't really have a trail, I initially wanted to ski them because it would just be easier. And I say that with respect to the fact that you would already need to be able to ski them, but it would require less bushwhacking. It would be a lot more simple. So I started with some backcountry skiing, focused mostly in Little Cottonwood area, ticking off some of those summits that didn't really have trails. And you get to explore some really amazing things. The Wasatch is very well known for its backcountry skiing. So fortunately for me, a lot of that's already been mapped out. So it was just kind of taking what was existing and trying to do my best to duplicate it. Unfortunately for me, I ended up getting into a ski accident while I was out tagging one of the summits at the end of January, and I ended up breaking my fibula, and I had to self-rescue ski out of the canyon. And I missed the two best months of this like record ski season. So I had to kind of put the project on hold for at least 2.5 months until I was recovered enough to at least go out for some little hikes and stuff. But by that time, all the good snow was gone and I was very disappointed. But I think I managed 16 summits on skis in the month of January. Not as much as I wanted, but otherwise heinous if you had to do them in the summertime.
I mean, you're young and you're healthy and you recovered quickly to be able to even entertain the thought of finishing this project as you did. That's wild.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about your running background. I know you're on the Solomon running team. So that's, you have to be pretty accomplished to do that.
Yeah. So I think 2023 is my 10th year of running. I grew up playing soccer and then went to college without soccer and had this void. Turns out I was really just missing the running aspect of soccer. Went out for a short run when I was in college, and that run turned into an 8-miler. And I think very quickly I realized I was probably more inclined to endurance sports than I had ever thought. I bought a ton of books on it, just became obsessed, started trail running. I met the trail community, which was really it. That's usually what gets most people, and then fell in love with it and moved to Salt Lake in 2016. That's when the door really opened. So a lot of my running was really focused on just exploring. And that was such a fun endeavor. And then quickly learned that I was competitive, that soccer nature really took over, and would sign up for some races, and then kind of found my own strengths throughout the sport. And I joked about this with a coach in the past, but I am the runner who enjoys the training more than I do the racing. Getting myself to be fit enough to do a race was never really an issue. I would always be really up for the challenge. But yeah, it's been a really fun and rewarding sport to participate in. And then just being a woman in this sport now is probably one of the most rewarding aspects to it. Watching women take down some of these incredible things, teammates of mine, it's the most inspirational thing. It's probably something I hope to be part of for the rest of my life.
You talked about a couple minutes ago, the Whirl, which is the Wasatch Ultimate Ridge Line, Ridge Link Up.
Yeah.
Right. And they did a really interesting documentary. I saw kind of the intricacies of what you go through when you do a race like the Whirl. And I know a lot of people just check those peaks off between Little and Big Cottonwood Canyons, as you say, in that they go in kind of a horseshoe fashion. But it's a big goal of people just to do one at a time, let alone all of them. And as you also said, it's quite dangerous. And when we say dangerous, it is, some of the areas have sort of razor-like ridges.
Yeah, razor-like ridges, a lot of very loose boulders and talus that if you're not familiar with that terrain, it could be like stepping on a small landmine. It could create movement, knock you off your feet. And then there's some vertical sections that you have to either climb up or descend. So being very comfortable on exposed, dangerous terrain, there's quite a lot to that. Those talus fields. They're beautiful and majestic from the valley floor, but when you are on them, they can be pretty spooky.
So you also have a day job. I mean, you just don't do this as your profession. And yet you mentioned a lot of the days would be like 10-hour days, which I can absolutely imagine some of them may have even been longer. You're kind of have to be a weekend warrior. Is that how you did it?
Yeah, lots of big Saturdays. And I think the most difficult part was doing them back to back. So Saturday and Sunday. And then, yeah, some of the long weekends, most people were at barbecues. I was up in the mountains bushwhacking around. So yeah, taking advantage of every opportunity, evenings, early mornings for some of them, mostly with the skiing ones. A lot of those were very early mornings, trying to work it in. I work a full-time job. Luckily, I work from home, so it's a little bit easier, but very much time was not on my side for this project. But
how many of these summits did you do alone and how many did you do with others?
I think I was very lucky to get about half of them with friends. So some of those were the more technical ones, obviously, just because it's very good to have a partner in that setting. It's very dangerous. You really want to make sure that you have company. Most of the skiing were done with others, partners, and that's just the nature of backcountry skiing. I think only one or two of those I did solo, but on very familiar terrains. For the most part, all of the bushwhacking ones were on my own. I couldn't convince friends to go bushwhack across a ridgeline or something for a couple hours. They were not into that idea.
Yeah, I'm going to keep that Black Mountain on my list of hikes that I don't need to do. And then what was your navigation device?
So typically I used my phone, and there are a couple different apps that you can download. I typically used CalTopo, and Strava actually has maps that you can download. And so that means you have access to the map and your physical location will show up on it, even if you don't have cell service. So a lot of my route planning was done, obviously, preemptively. I would have relatively an idea of where I was going, if there was a trail, and if I had diverged from the trail, where it would begin, where it would end. Typically, I was using a combination of those two apps at any given point. It's always good to kind of make sure that you're in the same spot on more than one, especially if you're in unfamiliar territory. So those are pretty much my go-tos for the entirety. And they proved to be very fruitful because I don't think I got lost a single time.
Did you also have some sort of device that you could send out a message on, again, like a Garmin inReach?
Yeah. So actually, if you have a newer version of your cell phone, it does have a GPS notification that you can send out if you're in distress. But I did have a cell phone. This is maybe just due to my personal experience. When I'm skiing, I have a beacon. But when I'm trail running, I like to do just the basic of letting someone know. So that's either a friend or a relative or my partner, let them know where I'm going to be that day and kind of my estimate of things. And I was pleasantly surprised. Once you get high enough, you actually have a good amount of cell service. So I was able to kind of shoot off messages of updates along the way, just so people kind of were aware if I was making progress, if there was an issue. So I wasn't super concerned about it. And I'm also just very practiced and disciplined when I get into terrain like that because I do it so much. I don't usually rely on having help. So there's always a good kind of indicator of whether or not you should attempt something, and it's whether or not you can get yourself out of it. So having the skills, the wherewithal to figure out what to do if you're in a dangerous situation, how popular is the area you're going to go to, are you likely to encounter other people? And then just generally, how can you account for yourself? Are you setting yourself up for success with supplies? So do you have enough things if you're in danger? You kind of have to look out for yourself in a lot of ways, but I don't like to rely on, you know, search and rescue, because often if I was going to be in those sticky situations very far out, it's unlikely that, you know, you're putting other people's lives in danger. And obviously they're also trained professionals, but it's really on your own. You got to figure it out on yourself and rely on your own skills. So I caution anyone who wants to do something that's a little bit more dangerous, just really make sure that you check before you go, kind of what everything you need, what's the potential weather, what are your water sources, and how you're going to help yourself, because those are kind of the big things you got to worry about first and foremost before you go have an adventure.
Absolutely. Well, with all of that said, is there any one kind of crazy story that you'd like to share with our listeners about something that happened that you weren't expecting, from, I don't know, wildlife to a sprained ankle?
You know, I wish I had a sprained ankle, but I, you know, you can break your ankle in a lot of places. So I think wildlife, I was very fortunate. I saw quite a few remarkable things, but I think the coolest one I was able to encounter this year was a Little Black Mountain, the one with the real trail. I had that summit all to myself, albeit it's a pretty popular one for a lot of Salt Lake folks. But I was running back along the ridge about to descend the mountain, and I almost stepped on a little cluster of birds, and they were very small. And one of them turned around and was kind of threatening me, and he was wiggling his butt, and he was about the size of a baseball, and I thought it was just the most adorable thing I've ever seen. And I took a video because I had never seen a bird like that. It had eyes like the quintessential cute animals, these big round adorable black eyes, and turns out it's a nighthawk, which I had never seen before, and the males are pretty I guess aggressive. And so they are not, as a species of bird, they're not doing so great. And I think it's because they try to attack animals that are much larger than them. But it was just this really surreal moment. You know, I was anywhere from a foot to 3 feet away from it, trying to figure out how to get around this very tiny bird who was not willing to get off the trail. And I think just in terms of nature, that was kind of one of the coolest experiences, because, you know, there was no one else around. It was just me. And I got to just have this very up close and personal interaction with this new to me species of animal. And I've encountered since then, you know, tons of rattlesnakes, but those are not new to me. You see them all the time around in the Wasatch. But just having, I think, a bird encounter was very unexpected for me, especially one on the ground. So yeah, I think there's a lot of things to be found in the Wasatch, especially in Salt Lake area. So I encourage people to maybe venture out of their, you know, comfort zones a little bit, try a new trail. There's definitely things that you are not exposing yourself to by doing the same trail often. And I say that as a creature of habit myself. Yeah, there's so many beautiful things out there. It's rich with history too.
What a great story. Wanted to ask you about how you're publishing this so that other people can maybe create their own sort of bucket list from your experience.
Yeah. So currently I have everything listed. I GPS tracked everything and took tons of photos. So everything is documented on my website, and that's charliemckee.com. But in the near future, I really hope to be able to produce an actual guidebook that has all the summer information and the winter information. So anyone who wants to access these summits, hopefully there'll be a place. It's a lot easier for them to go to. But if you need a map right now, or you want just the GPS data, you can go to my website and have all of it.
Charlie McKee is my guest, and she summited all the peaks in Salt Lake County over 9 months, 21 days, both on skis and running. Charlie, thanks so much for joining me on The Mountain Life. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me.